Wilson Motor Speedway. It's the talk of Gasoline Alley. Tony Donahue and Donald Davidson with you on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Over the next hour, we will be taking your calls of a nostalgic nature. Donald, it's pretty cool to be here when basically it's just the three of us. Well, Jim Ayala's still here hanging out. He doesn't want to go home. So the four of us will do some radio. We'll listen in, and we'll have a great time. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I'm still recovering from the weekend. I'm stunned.
I'm telling you. I was stunned because I just introduced you to the ABC Delta Force intros from the late 80s and early 90s. Yep, those are fun to watch.
That's television, right?
Yep, that's on the television. Okay. So
We're getting a lot of television these days.
Yep.
we only do radio.
Yeah. But yesterday again, and I know, please reiterate the historical values of Simon Pagenaud's Indianapolis 500 pole run yesterday, no Rene Thomas, 1919. But go ahead and get the folks out there that may not have been able to tune in to the qualifying show yesterday, just some of the historical values that we saw yesterday.
Okay, well, then somebody, as you were telling me just before we went off, somebody else has come up with some interesting information. But it just occurred to me, and I should have done some of this in preparation, but when it was Pagenaud, I thought, golly, a Frenchman on the pole. When's the last time that happened? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I know Rene Thomas in 1919, and I had to quickly go through the list, and that's the last time it happened that a Frenchman was on the pole was 100 years ago. But you said somebody either called or tweeted or twittered or whatever the heck the term is.
I did see that. I think it might have been Lawrence Barkman told me that the last time
I know her.
It was 1919, and Howdy Wilcox from Indiana started second and won the race.
He was from Crawfordsville, and he did start second driving a Peugeot. In fact, this is, I'll draw another one all right. So this year we've got I'm not doing this very well. In 1919, it was the last year for single-lap qualifying, but Thomas was on the pole with a French fellow, and he was the 1914 winner. And I'll just go on a bit of a tangent here. I find this fascinating. I really feel for this fellow. The riding mechanic for Thomas in 1914 was Robert Lally, L-A-L-A-Y, and... L-A-L-Y. I don't know if I said that correctly. Anyway, went in 1919 when they came back from the war, and Thomas was on the pole with a Ballot. Lally was the riding mechanic again. Well, Thomas was involved in the war, as was Jules Gou and some of the other French. Lally had been a prisoner of war during the 5 years that he was absent from here. Not for the entire 5 years, but I just found that rather moving. And take it a step further, Georges Boileau, who set the track record in 1914 and almost did the first 100-mile-an-hour lap, he and Gou and Thomas and the others were all at the front in a very short time, driving the generals around, except that Boileau was a pilot, and he got shot down. I think on May the 23rd of 1916, and the Americans were still going, and the 300-mile version of the 500-mile race was being held, and Boileau was a casualty over Verdun. Anyway, so to maybe make it a little more pleasant here, the fact that in 1919, Thomas was on the pole. Howdy Wilcox, born in Crawfordsville, lived most of his life in Indianapolis, started second and won the race. And then somebody observed that 50 years ago, second place produced the winner. That was Mario Andretti. Mm-hmm. And now we've got Pagenaud on the pole with an American named Ed Carpenter next to him. And wouldn't that be great if he was to win? Mm-hmm. And then there's another little bit of an irony. The Peugeot, which Wilcox drove to victory, was owned by the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Team Company. Mm. And that was Carl Fisher and Jim Allison. And the car was kept in what was to become Allison's Plant One. The Indianapolis Speedway Team Company became Allison Experimental, and then Allison Engineering. And so the building down there that's right across from Dallara is where the 1919 winner was housed and prepared, owned by Fisher and Allison, and now Ed Carpenter Racing. you have to think that there might be some Speedway-connected, Speedway family connections in within that team. So that would be amazing. And golly, if Ed was to win, would that be the great story of all time or not?
That would be great. That would be top for me. I can tell you, I'm not supposed to show favoritism while I'm up here, but I think we would all. We would all let out a couple collapse. So 239-1070, 317-239-1070, your calls of a nostalgic nature. Here on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with the IMS historian Donald Davidson. Let's head to Toledo, Ohio. Donald, Jason is on hold. Jason, go ahead.
Hi, Jason.
Hi, Donald. Pleasure to speak to you again.
Well, thank you. We were up your way, about a month ago, I think.
Right. My question tonight. Has to do, I guess, McLaren's difficulties in qualifying got me thinking this year.
Yes.
About other surprising events, be they good or bad, you know, things that just were unexpected that happened during qualifying, and if you could address some of those.
Well, there's been a bunch of those. Probably the one that everybody would think about was the Penske team not making it in 1995. In 94, they had a three-car team. Came very close to getting a 1-2 with Fittipaldi and Al Jr. And Fittipaldi was coming up to lap Al and then got into the rumble strips with the Ilmor engine. It was called a Mercedes-Benz, but it was actually Ilmor with a Mercedes-Benz badge on it. But anyway, Fittipaldi tagged the wall and Little Al went on to win. But that engine only ran the one race. Now, for the rest of the year on the kart circuit, the Penske cars were powered by Mercedes-Benz engines, but they not only were they not really Mercedes-Benz, they were not the same engine, which was the pushrod Ilmor that had run here. That engine only ran the 94 500. Well, they came back the following year with that they couldn't use that engine again. And they had great difficulty right off the bat. And it was fascinating to see this develop, rather like we've seen this week with Alonso and the McLaren, except there was more time for the Penske people to go through their trials and tribulations. And from early on, they appeared to be in trouble. And the thinking was that the chassis... It was the same chassis that they used the year before, but that the Ilmor Mercedes engine was so strong that it overpowered any handling difficulties that they may have had. And when they didn't have as much power, they didn't have the speed. So, golly, there was all kinds. They had Renards. They had all kinds of help and swapping back and forth. And it came down to... late on the third day, Fittipaldi went out and made an attempt, which would have been a marginal, but they decided to yellow flag him and come back the next day. Hindsight, maybe they could have let him go, and that speed might have held up. Well, anyway, so they come back on Sunday with Little Al and Fittipaldi, and... They let Fittipaldi had used up an attempt, so he had two left because it was only three attempts per car then, and one checkered flag. That was back with the up to three, but only one checkered flag, and so he went out fairly late. And I'm trying to think whether Little Al had gone first, but anyway, he was too slow to get in, but Fittipaldi. Was allowed to do the four laps, and he was marginally slower than the three-lap average of the day before, if this makes any sense, and maybe it doesn't. But they could have yellow-flagged him for the second time and still had a chance to get on the back of the line and come back through again. But they decided to let him keep the time, and then it ended up that it got it was bumped. And so that was quite stunning. And I remember that there was all kinds of talk. Well, gee, you know, this is a a two-time winner and a well, two-time winners, and it's Penske, and that maybe a deal will be made for them to either buy cars. I remember somebody called in onto the Drive Home show and the equivalent of this to say, we've heard a rumor that Tony George and Penske are talking and that they're going to add a 12th row. Well, they didn't do that. In fact, Penske's the cars that they tried to qualify on the last weekend, I think they got from Bobby Rahal. Anyway, instead of trying anything like that, Penske said, no, we played by the rules and we lost and we're going home. So they packed everything up, took all the signs down. And so if you came into the garage the next day, they were gone. And the drivers came back, and I think they went up into the suites because Penske's guests still came. But anyway, that was right up there. Another one was Roger Ward in 1965. The previous 6 years, he had finished first, second, third, first, fourth, and second. That's from 59 through 64. So that's four consecutive years with a fourth place being the worst. Or the most disappointing, if you like. And then in 65, he had a real struggle with a brand new rear engine car that looked like it was going to be on the front row. And it came down to the final day, and well, actually on the Saturday, the fourth day, he went out and spun and hit the wall right before taking the green. And it was not a major accident, but I remember that they borrowed the nose cone off of the Don Branson car, which was the twin sister, in order to go out and run on Sunday. And then I don't remember if they... I know the nose cone when he went out to make a late attempt was correct for the car. So... they must have done a quick paint job or something. Anyway, so Roger went out, and it was like, I think, between 5:30, 20 to 6 or something like that. And he was trying to get Bumper's way into the field, and he came up just a little bit short of bumping Bill Cheeseburg. And so he's the first alternate. And I remember thinking that, you know, how stunning that was at the time. But carbs are coming up in a couple of days. Maybe somebody will have a problem, and Roger will come in, because they used to have alternate starters in those days, which they don't do anymore. I kind of miss that. I like the idea of the alternate starters. But anyway, so nothing happened on Carburation Day, and Roger Woods didn't start the race. And I remember thinking at the time, that really adds to the credibility of the event. It's the fastest 33 qualifiers. There's no promoter's options. You don't stick somebody on the back. And so Roger did television commentary. It was closed circuit TV in those days, MCA. And so he was the driver expert. So I suppose those would be the two when you come down to the... till the last minute. I'll probably think of some other ones where somebody major didn't matter. Well, Bobby Rahal, golly, got was bumped in 93 and came back with another car and was unable to bump his way back in. I remember that was kind of a surprise. So I guess there's been quite a few of those.
Yeah, and we saw it again yesterday.
Yes,
Jason,
by golly.
Up in Toledo, thanks for the call. Great stuff there, and very relevant as of what we saw yesterday. Let's move on before the first break here, Donald. This might be a two-parter, so we can start it, and then we can pick this back up. But we can go to Jerry in Delphi. Jerry's been on hold. He's been a loyal caller throughout the entire week, or the 2 weeks, really 3 weeks.
He's been a loyal caller since we started the program, I think.
Jerry, welcome back to the program. Thanks for calling in to the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Hi, Jerry. I saw you in the museum today. What's up?
Yeah, good seeing you, Donald. And hi, everybody. I'd just like to know if you'd profile one driver down there. Got his wings down there at Speedway by the name of Jack Turner.
Jack Turner?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, poor Jack Turner. Jack was from Seattle, Washington, and an outstanding midget car driver. And he was the AAA champion, national champion in 1954 and 1955. and he did all of his own mechanical work. And I think midget car racing was probably, I suppose people would consider that his forte. He did drive some sprint cars, and he did drive championship cars. And he was at the Indianapolis Speedway between 1956 and 1963. And he did not qualify in 60 or 63, but 56, 57, 58, and 59, and then 61 and 62. The best finish that he had was 11th in 1957. Drove the Travelon Trader Special in 56 and was 25th. Wally Muskowski was the chief mechanic. I started trying to put these things into more of a nutshell rather than go by year, which I haven't done for a while, but what the heck. Bardo Special for Pat Clancy in 1957, and he was 11th. 58, it was the Massalia Hotel Special owned by Hart Fullerton. Chief mechanic was Ray Gardner, who was the brother of Chet Gardner, who had been a driver before the war. Turner was involved in the first lap accident and suffered damage, made several pit stops, struggled on for a while, finally gave up and got 25th. Then 1959, with the Travelon Trailer Special, which was lime green, and he had a good run with that, but had a mechanical failure and was 27th. And then Bobby Grimm, and gone off on another tangent here. Bobby Grimm, born in Coal City, Indiana, and had qualified fifth in 59 and would win Rookie of the Year during the about 70-something laps into the race. He had a mechanical failure, a drive shaft or something. And so he did what he had been doing in sprint cars for years and midgets, and that was to raise one hand to warn the drivers behind him. And on a midget track, that was probably okay, but the Indianapolis Speedway was going a little faster, and it pulled his arm out of the socket. And so he came in, and obviously wincing in pain, and the crew got him out, not realizing what the problem was yet, and put Jack Turner in as a relief. And Turner, I think, was sort of probably lurched for about a foot and a half and stopped. And Grimm had been able to tell, unable to tell them that the transmission was shot. So I love that trivia because when in doing investigation on relief drivers, I had all these different categories. And one of them was drivers that climbed into a car during the race and never left the pits. And so Jack Turner fit into that category. All right, then 1960, he was back with the Kelso Auto Dynamic Special, which was very similar to the Johnny Thompson pole car from 59, but it made a qualifying attempt but did not make the race. In fact, that car was entered for the 500 twice and never made it. It never ran in an auto race, so it's part of the museum collection today, and it's basically a brand-new car. It's got very few miles on it. Anyway, Jack Turner went out with the Bardal Special to try and get into the field, and he spun before taking the green flag. So 61, back with the Bardal Special, back and was actually got up to second. There was pit stop shuffles going on, but he did get to second, and then he got involved in a multi-car accident involving Don Davis, Bill Cheeseburg, Roger McCluskey, and A.J. Shepard. And a little bit of trivia, three of the four drivers that were in it before he arrived were from Arizona. Don't know why that matters. Maybe it doesn't. Anyway, Turner flipped end over end, which was pretty hard to do at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in a roadster. And then 62, he had a very similar incident with a four-car accident in which will eliminated Chuck Rohde and Alan Crow, and there was another driver involved in that, but I won't identify him at this point. And Turner I think flipped in that. Anyway, he did have a major shunt, and either in 61 or 62 he did actually receive an injury. He got out of the car, and as he was getting into the ambulance, he slipped off the the running board, if you like, and broke his toe. Now, I've got about another 2 or 3 minutes to go here. Shall I keep going, or do we need to take a break?
No, go ahead. We'll give you, we'll give you 3 minutes. How about that?
All right. I'll hurry it up here. And so in 63, he came back to drive for George D., Bob Voigt, and Dick Summers. And I think I've talked about that. Colorful ownership in the past. Eddie Sachs was the teammate, and Jack Turner was out on the second qualifying day in the morning practice, came off of turn two, and got into and did a slid sideways. The tires dug in, and he did a very elaborate side over side over side over side. It was, I don't know that you would call it a flip. It was like barrel roll sideways, and I don't know how many times. But carted off to the hospital again. And Johnny Boyd tells the story that he was sitting ready to go out, and somebody, the yellow came on, and Boyd asked a crew member, oh, what happened? And they said, it's Turner. And so he said, oh, finally put that SB in the wall, huh? And the crew were surprised because Boyd and Jack Turner were very good friends. Well, it turns out that he'd misunderstood. He thought it was Curtis Turner in the smoky unit car. So we cleared that out. He then goes over to the hospital, and Jack Turner was sitting on the bed with his arms folded and a pout saying, I quit. And so anyway, that's what everybody remembers him for. And there's another example. There are a number, and I've got this theory. When it happens at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, it's forever. It never goes away. And in 1984, Jack Turner was one of the inaugural inductees into what was then the AAA USAC Midget Hall of Fame. Inductions were at the Speedrome. Jack came in, and I had the honor of driving him around. I had met him before, back when he was part of the Champion Highway Safety Program. And so people said, oh, I remember you. You got upside down, blah, 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 blah. And as we were driving around, he said, you know, that hurts me a little bit. He said, I've been dealing with that for years. And people think that it was funny. They make jokes about it. He said, I thought I had a pretty good career. And in championship racing, what is now IndyCar racing, championship racing, he actually had a second in the Darlington 200 in 1956. Pat O'Connor won it. Jack Turner was second. And he said, I thought I had a pretty good career, won a couple of midget championships, did well in other series. And he said, all anybody remembers is I got upside down at the Speedway 3 years in a row. But anyway, so Cactus Jack Turner, a very good golfer, and just a very colorful person who just did not look like a race driver. By golly, he was one and did a lot of his own mechanical work.
There we go. Jerry up in Delphi, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening every night and being a loyal listener here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan to the Talk of Gasoline. Now, when we return, we'll get back to your calls of a nostalgic nature centered around the Indianapolis 500 as we get ever closer to the 103rd running coming up right here on The Fan on Sunday. Wanted to mention this as well. Tomorrow, I will be with Johnny Rutherford from 5 until 6 at the Kroger location on 8130 East Southport Road down near the Greenwood area with our friends at Budweiser and Frito-Lay. So come down and meet Lone Star JR. We'll be back right after this. FM 107.5 and 1070, The Fan. Welcome back to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070. The Fan, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson with us. And Donald, I know you had a nice little visitor to the Speedway today. You, in the museum, you saw Bobby Unser.
We did, yes. It was just late in the day, and somebody said Bobby Unser's in the museum with some of the students that are yellow shirts. I guess they had like interns that were yellow shirts. And so I went over there and razzed with him just a little bit. In fact, boy, I've got to be careful with some of this material. He said, he turned to everybody and he said, now, he's the one that a few years ago told me who I was. And I thought, well, you got some of it wrong over the years. But anyway, but yes, Bobby is back and a great three-time champion of the Indianapolis 500. And he's going to be signing autographs tomorrow at Curlis Jewelers. And that's up on 86th Street. It's right across from Half Price Books. I think it's pretty close to Ditch. Is that 86th and Ditch? I think approximately.
Yep.
Anyway, in that on the north side, there's that. I don't know if you'd call it a strip mall, but anyway, Curlis Jewelers is right in there, and Bobby will be there between 5 and 7. And Peter Curlis, who I've known for years, and I know I talked about him, I think a couple of weeks ago. And for those of you that go back away and you have a book called The Race, there's two books called The Race. This is the one that came out in 1958, published by Bob's Barrel. And it is a large format with photographs that are in black and white. There's some incredible character studies in there. For the time, it was just an astonishing piece of work. And the prose was written by Angelo Angelopoulos, who wrote for, I think, the Indianapolis Times when there were three newspapers here locally. And then his younger brother was Jimmy Angelopoulos, who wrote for the News for many years. And they had a sister, and Peter Curlis is the son of the sister who... So, in other words, he's Angelo Angelopoulos, Angelo and Jimmy Angelopoulos' nephew. Anyway, so that's at Curlis Jewelers tomorrow, 5 to 7, up on 86th Street. And then some other opportunities, I'm thinking.
Real quick. That's
yes, go ahead.
It's 1466 West 86th Street.
Okay.
So 1466 West 86th Street is the address.
All right, Tony, thank you. And then other opportunities, because I know there's a few that are not open to the public necessarily, but a couple that are on Saturday. Come on out. If you're not going down to see the parade, the vintage cars will be on the track. Many roadsters since we're celebrating the 60s. And then there's a huge memorabilia swap meet, fabulous, in the one of the chalets in the pavilion in the plaza area, and then also the autograph session. And then before the driver's meeting on Saturday, I think from 9 until 10, they have all 33 of the current field sign autographs, and if you're going to come out and try and get them all, I don't think that'll work. If you get 6 or 8, you'll be doing pretty well. But then in the afternoon, there's a couple of sessions with the returning veterans, and there may be some winners in there, and there'll be some of the fellows that sort of came up through the sprints and just had a couple of starts. I haven't seen the final list, but typically there's like a 75. You know, 100 people.
Yep,
and
I've been to it many times.
So there's some tough ones that you'll find there, and they are just as happy to see the fans as the fans are to see them. So a lot of activities coming up.
IMS.com for more information on that, and don't forget 1070thefan.com. Check out the events page for our Budweiser Legends of Racing autograph sessions, and again, Johnny Rutherford tomorrow down on East Southport Road, starting at 5 o'clock. All right, back to the phone lines we go, Donald. Let's go up to Northwest Indiana. Where I'm from. Marty's on line number one. Marty, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Marty.
Hi, Dal. Nice to talk to you again.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you could talk about the five-car Bugatti contingent that raced at in the 500 in 1923, and also if you could talk about the background of, if I'm pronouncing his name right, Prince Bertrand.
Desistria. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, golly, I wonder why them, but it's funny that you'd ask about them because I have not used this yet, but that is a heavy-duty trivia question, and I do have people from time to time that come up and suggest that they might be... in a position to take over my job when I decide to step down. In fact, somebody in the garage area two or three days ago in front of a bunch of people came up, stuck his head in the front of the golf cart and said in front of his guests, I am told that you are the only person that knows more about the Indianapolis Speedway than I do. And I don't know who this fellow was, and I don't know who made that observation, and they may well be right. But I thought I should come back and give a trivia question. Say, well, all right, let's see how good you are. Name the five drivers on the Bugatti team in 1923. If you can name those, you're good. Anyway, there were in the 1923 was the first year for the engine sizes to be reduced yet again. They kept trying to get more out of less, and they reduced from 183 cubic inches down to 122, which I think is 2 liters. Anyway, be that as it may, this was very encouraging. And they also, the riding mechanics were no longer mandatory, and so a number of single seaters were created by Harry Miller, the American, and then the Duesenbergs went to single seaters, and then also there were 3 cars that came from Mercedes. This is before the days of Mercedes Benz. It was those were separate firms, and so I think it was Daimler Motorrennen Gesellschaft or Gesellschaft or something like that, and that was the 3 Mercedes, or actually 4 came with Alfred Neubauer. But there was a team of very colorful gentlemen who came with Bugattis. There were 5 of them, and golly, I don't know who to take first here, except that Marty mentions De Sistria, Prince Bertrand De Sistria. And he ended up not taking a relief driver, going the 500 miles and finishing 9th. The others were Pierre de Vizcaya, and I think he was the son of a banker who had helped Ettore Bugatti. Bugatti is another one. I've been playing around here with the 2019 starting lineup and trying to break them down into nationalities, and that's a little difficult to do because not everybody is now what they started out to be. But be that as it may, Bugatti actually before World War I was a German entrant. And then when they came back after the war, then he was, I suppose, more French than German. But anyway, I'm getting a little bit complicated here. So we've got Prince Bertrand de Sistria, Pierre de Vizcaya, and then we had 2 Argentinians named Raul Raganti, who had 3 starts in the Indianapolis 500, 1923, 1933, and 1940. And anyway, then the other Argentinian was Martin de Alzaga. And then the 5th one was Count Louis Farov Zabrowski. What nationality was he? English. and actually, he had his father was a Polish count, and his mother was an American. And so pretty colorful bunch. I would imagine that they spent a lot of time at St. Elmo's since they were all reasonably well-to-do. And Martin de Alzaga spent some time in Hollywood, and he had a nightclub, and I can't remember the nightclub's name now, but he was courting an actress. And I hadn't thought about this for years, and I can't think of her name. She was a lesser light as far as Hollywood actresses are concerned. That may come to me, or maybe there's a film buff can call this one in. Anyway, she ended up, she never married De Alzaga, but she did marry Clark Gable and bore Clark Gable the only child that he had. So John Clark Gable was born to the lady who was being courted by Martin de Alzaga, and that should come to me, but it isn't at the moment. But it's not a major name.
Is the connection, no, I don't know the actress' name, yeah, but it was a connection with To Impress a Lady, that movie?
With the what?
To Please a Lady? Or To Please a Lady.
No. She just played minor roles, mm-hmm. and No, that was by the time To Please a Lady in 1950. When they got married, I don't know, but The Misfits was, I think Clark Gable actually passed away before it was released, I think. I think he passed away with just in a very short time of the filming ending. And that was ironic that the three, we're talking about movies now, not even about racing movies, but Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe and Montgomery Clift were all deceased within in a very short time. Can't think of the actress's name. Was it Williams? I don't know.
It'll come to
me when I'm driving home.
We will update you tomorrow.
But anyway, so of the Bugattis, the Vizcaya, the Raganti, De Alsaga was the first one out, and purchased a Miller before he left. And then the next one out was Raganti, and Zabrowski, and then Pierre de Vizcaya dropped out late, I think 166 laps, and so he would be ranked 12th, although he wasn't running at the end. And Prince Bertrand de Sistria was 9th, and I think it was the following year he was the one that was fatally injured in an automobile accident in Paris. And anyway, very, very colorful bunch. So it's interesting that Marty would call that in, because I don't know how many times I've thought of that, and I've never done this to anybody, but I thought if somebody would give me a hard time about how much they knew, I'd say, all right, tell me who the five Bugatti drivers were in 1923.
All right, Marty in Northwest Indiana, thanks for the call. We'll get to a short timeout. Got a couple more minutes left to get to your calls of a nostalgic nature here live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070, The Fan. Welcome back to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for a final time here on the Talk of Gasoline Alley, FM 107.5 and 1070. The Fan, Tony Donahue with Donald Davidson, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We've got a couple minutes left here on the program. Don't forget all podcasts, 1070thefan.com. Let's go down to Franklin. Bill joins the program. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Donald, it's so good to hear me. I was in the hospital last year, and so I didn't get to hear the race, but I have a Where They Are Now segment. Chris McClure, Mike Ahearn,
yes,
Ron Carroll. Well, we know Ron Carroll's deceased. Doug Zink, and whatever happened to Mike Sarowitz, who used to do the all night race party?
I don't know. You said Chris McClure?
Yes, sir.
I know that name, but he was not. Are you talking about Radio Network people?
Yes, sir.
Okay, but Doug Zink, yes, and Mike Ahearn, yes, Ron Carroll, yes, but Chris McClure, I remember that name.
He was on one of the all-night race shows with Mike Sarowitz.
Oh, okay.
And last but not least, I remember one time Sid had a humorous thought. He used to call Jimmy Shelton Jimmy. Poor Jim was having trouble with that mic on that northeast turn, and he kept saying, I guess Charlie, he said, let's get Charlie 3. Is Charlie still alive? He used to be engineer at WIBC.
Which Charlie? I remember a Charlie, but what was his surname?
Charlie 3.
I don't remember him. I know they had an engineer named Will Fix, which was a great name for an engineer. And but do you have a question there, or you just want to recall the names?
Just wanted to recall the names. I know Jim kept saying, Jimmy, let's get your mic fixed. Jim kept cutting out, and you know how humorous Sid was, God rest his soul.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for the call, Bill. Glad you're feeling better and tuning back into the program here in the month of May. We'll be back tomorrow on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Derek down in Greenwood, as well as Kevin and Camby. We can get to you guys tomorrow night if you want to dial it back up from 8 o'clock in till 9. Donald, another fun show. We're through it.
Thank you, Tony. Yes.
Yesterday was fun. Tonight has been another great show.
We've only got four more to go.
I know. It's
no.
You know, we started this, was it 2 weeks ago tonight? Yes. And we've gone every weeknight. But don't forget, you can always tune in on the podcast page at 1070thefan.com. I know it's a little bit different than last year, but now Talk of Gasoline Alley has its own. You can go on, listen whenever you want. So if you have a long road trip or you're traveling into the Indianapolis 500 over the next week, I know my father's coming in from Seattle, so he'll be tuning in as well. So
Fernando Alonso missed the show.
I mean, it still hasn't... still hasn't really, I mean, it's set
it's
in,
stunning.
But it is. It is.
To me, that is stunning.
And great for Kyle Kaiser. But again, Fernando Alonso, I think this will make him hungrier to want to come back and to try to go for that triple crown as well. But, yeah, what a historical day we saw yesterday. It was one of the most impressive qualifying days from top to bottom with the Fast 9 shootout and then the back row shootout as well.
Saturday was unbelievable.
Saturday was a lot of fun as well. All right, for Donald Davidson and Brad Huber back in the studio. Zach's with us out here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll be back tomorrow night with another edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. You're listening to FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.